Okay. We'll start with a few announcements. Fair number of people are not here. Well, that's the way it goes. We'll start with a couple of announcements and then go on to some of the questions you had about last lecture. And okay, so the announcements, the first thing is the assignments are due on Wednesday. That is what topic you're going to talk about in your presentation. And so for that, you'll have pick out an article, a research article, and then also a review article, which gives you some background into the biology or the technology or both, and some general textbooks. What you need to give to me on Wednesday is the article and the review article, and you can put down a couple of textbooks if you have them. Give you me a half a page to one page write-up in terms of, you know, why you chose the article, what's interesting about it, what you think the major technical innovation is, assuming it has a technical innovation, or what is the main biological point. I strongly encourage you to talk with me, because this is non-trivial. And so many of you may pick an article which ends up not being optimal. So come talk to me and don't leave it to the last minute. I'm here after class. You can email me anytime or come by pretty much anytime or give me a call. Okay. Also, I was looking at the calendar and I realized, like, on this Wednesday, we were supposed to have the midterm exam, so I've put it off a little bit because that's a little too close. So March 10th, we'll have the midterm exam here in class. And basically, what I would do is I would review your homeworks, review the quizzes, and the lecture notes, and review the readings, in particular going through and finding out in the readings, you know, the main chapter and subchapter headings and the words in bold or italics. What I would like to do is I would like to give you a presentation somewhat earlier than we had initially. And I was looking through, again, the calendar, and it seems like the best is to have in the evenings, to have it March 27th and March 28th. Is anybody wrapped up, cannot make in the evenings? What I'll do is I'll order a pizza, something like that. You cannot make it. Either of those times?
Because we have the qualification exam on
28th. Oh, gosh. Yeah?
I might not be able to make one of those days. I have to work sometime in there. I can't remember the schedule.
Okay.
I've got a time.
Man. But you'll be out of town both of these days? You'll be out both of these days? Okay, I'll give it some thought. Okay, in terms of some of the questions that you had for last lecture, there seemed to be some confusion about reviewing. For example, for a dipole field that U, the energy, is equal to P dot E, where E is the electric field, I suggest, you know, you basically go and look in your undergraduate classical E&M. Okay, one person wrote, I still don't understand how photo bleaching works. Can you control when it bleaches? The answer is, we do not know. That is, you excite the molecule, and generally it will emit fluorescence. And then at some point, it will undergo some sort of chemical reaction and go into a non-fluorescent, permanently photobleached state. What that process is actually not well understood. In general, a common method is oxygen is floating around in solution, and the oxygen reacts with the excited state of the fluorophore. And then instead of fluorescing, it reacts again with the oxygen and goes into some other non-fluorescent state. Occasionally, it will go into a state that is not permanently photobleached, and then it'll come back to the ground state and then get excited and then can emit. But in general, it will react with the oxygen permanently and be non-fluorescent. The variables in the classical E&M problem started to confuse me. I lost track of what they meant. Again, I would go over the lecture. If you have any questions, feel free to come and ask me. Okay, the theory of Fret, is this theory correct? No, what I'm doing is I'm BSing you. I mean, yes, it's correct. I like that. Is it correct? Okay, so another question asked about the Stokes shift. What is its importance? What is a Stokes shift? Yeah.
The molecules when absorbs energy has a lot more energy than when it emits it as a fluorescence, because when it absorbs energy, it goes to the higher vibrational energy level.
Yeah.
But then loses this excess energy and comes to the ground state, then has fluorescence.
Okay. Its absorption looks like this. And then it loses some energy, goes down to the lowest excited singlet state, and then from here it emits a photon and then loses a bit of energy. So its absorption profile looks like this, and then its emission profile here typically looks like this. So this is the emission, and the Stokes shift is defined as the difference between the absorption peak and the emission peak. Okay, I think I'm generally confused by the lack of units in this lecture. For example, I'm still not sure what the units of K should be. So, for example, over here, there's some excited state lifetime, and it, in general, will come down as e to the minus kt, which is equal to minus over tau. Well, let's say this is the donor, for example. So e to the minus kt. So what units does k have?
It's to the minus.
What's that?
Kt is unit, so divide by t, you get k.
Right. This is has no units, so t has units of seconds or whatever, so k has units of seconds to the minus 1. And in general, you know, feel free to ask me when I'm going through things. Okay, this is an interesting question. Why do we use this new fluorescence intensity, that is FRET, as a way, instead of just using the double Fiona method, that is Schreck? Okay, that's a good question. So Schreck, we found out, was a way of measuring the resolution between two different dyes. And FRET, similarly, is a way of measuring the resolution between a donor acceptor. So why do you use Schreck as opposed to Fiona? Why do Schreck as opposed to FRET? Or why do you use FRET as opposed to Schreck? What distance scale is FRET useful for? You said 5 nanometers? Yeah, what general range is FRET good for? 5 nanometers is basically correct, but if it's 4 nanometers, is it useful? If it's 6 nanometers, is it useful? 10 nanometers? 40 nanometers?
Between 4 and 40 nanometers.
Okay, no? Anybody know? Well, it's like 3 to 8 nanometers, or 30 to 80 angstroms. And Schreck, remember, Schreck is essentially a two-dimensional Fiona. And Fiona, what distance scales is it useful? Yeah, like 1 nanometer to what? If Fiona is looking at some step or something, how big of a step can it measure? Secret? Why do you say 100 nanometers?
Because on your eyes you measure the stable.
Yes. That's true. That was 74 nanometers. But what if it was bigger? Let's say instead of walking 74 nanometers, let's say the thing was 100 nanometers, or let's say the thing was 200 nanometers. Could you tell it? With Fiona, what's the limit? Somebody said you get a nanometer accuracy. How come you get a nanometer? What does that depend on? What's that? How many photons? Because you get here, and the uncertainty is the width. Divided by the square root of the number of photons. And so in general, you can determine this to on the order of a nanometer, nanometer and a half. Okay? So at one time it's one place, and then it takes a step and it's another place. And you have to measure the distance between them. So as long as it's greater than 1 nanometer, it should be fine. So if it's 100 nanometers or 200 nanometers, is it fine? Yeah, you say yes, absolutely. So always fine. So basically it's greater than 100 nanometers. Okay, Schreck, remember you have two colors. You determine Fiona. You determine where it is. You determine again with Fiona in the other ones, let's say a blue and a red die. Then you subtract them from each other, and you can tell the distance between them. That's resolution. Right? Resolution is when you have two molecules. The question is, can you tell the difference between them? So in terms of Shrek, then what is the resolution of this? How accurately can you determine this? What's that? Yeah. How accurately can you determine where this is? Oh, about a nanometer. So how accurately can you determine the distance between this and this? Yeah, the square root of, Well, you can determine this distance to about 1.5 nanometers. Now, in reality, it ends up being 8 to 10 nanometers, because it's not perfect. Okay? So that says Shrek, let's say 10 nanometers. But what about the upper range? How far, you have the blue and the red dye. So, okay, let's say it's 10 nanometers, so you can just make it out. Then what if it's 20 nanometers, 100 nanometers, 200 nanometers? Can you make it out? Yes. No problem. So it's greater than 10 nanometers. Okay, so the question was, why not always use Shrek instead of using Fret? And what's the right here it should tell. What's the answer? Michael? Exactly. If it's 3 to 8 nanometers apart, you use Fret. If it's greater than 8 nanometers, you can use Shrek. Yes, but yeah, that's correct. That's a good point. Shrek you can use for dynamic movement. You know, let's say at one point it's here and then it moves over here. But Fret you can use exactly for the same purpose. You can see Fret, it's one time it's here, another time it's here, another time it's there. Both of these are dynamic measurements. In fact, you can. In fact, we'll talk about that briefly. Okay? Okay, so we'll go through very rapidly a little bit of what we talked about last time. We'll finish off the Fret, and then we'll actually give you an example of first an ensemble Fret measurement, and then we'll actually go to a single molecule Fret measurement. The single molecule Fret measurement, it is amazing. In fact, I'm going to have you read the article. It's published in Science last year by Tik Chip Ha, who's a professor right down the hall. It's absolutely gorgeous. How with kinesin and molecular motors, we showed that it was a hand-over-hand type motion. This one we're going to find with a DNA called a helicase. It goes in a inchworm type motion. It's really amazing. Okay, so the general idea is if these two dyes are close together, you get a lot of energy transfer, and you come and you excite this guy, which emits in the green, though if it's close, it transfers energy to this red and then emits over here. So the amount of green fluorescent versus red fluorescence will tell us how close they are. And again, it's useful in 20 angstroms to about 80 angstroms. If it's more than 80 angstroms, essentially it's so far away that these guys don't ever see each other, so you just see green. If they're closer than 20 angstroms, essentially this transfers all of its energy over here, and you see only red. Okay, and this can actually be made quantitative from a donor to an acceptor over here, and again, when it's very close, it transfers essentially 100% of the energy. When it's very far, it transfers essentially zero. It goes like 1 over 1 plus R over R naught to the sixth. We derived, in fact, why this goes as a function of the sixth power. We have a order of magnitude as to, you know, what the amount of energy transfer is, namely R naught. This is the distance at which 50% of the energy is transferred. R naught is typically like 50 angstroms, and as you'll see in the following, why that's incredibly useful. Okay, in terms of how we measure it, we'll talk a little bit more about that today, but basically if the donor acceptor are close, the donor emits very little green and the acceptor emits a lot of red, and in particular also in terms of the donor's lifetime, the donor will be quite short because the donor is transferring energy to the acceptor. If it's a distance or away, that's about 50% energy transfer and they're approximately equal. If they're far apart, the donor essentially doesn't even know about the acceptor, so the donor emits quite a lot in green, and the amount of red fluorescence from the acceptor is very little. Similarly, the donor lifetime is fairly long. Why, in fact, if these guys are far away, why is the acceptor emitting at all? Yeah. You always have to worry about a possibility of energy transfer coming from another. So at that point, it's possible, but you essentially lower the concentration such that the chances of one guy seeing another guy is very poor. So that really isn't the answer. So even though these guys are far apart, the acceptor is still doing some absorption and emitting. Why is that? So for example, this is the donor. What does the emission look like? The emission the emitter has its absorption here. And its emission here. So here is the green, and here is the red fluorescence. The emitter has an absorbance that looks like here. So if you go and excite the donor, let's say right here, the emitter will also absorb some of the light. And so if it absorbs some of the light, it will emit. Okay? Energy transfer, I almost every single time, I have to look, does it look like this or not over R to the 6 or R not over R over R not to the 6? How do you know? Let's say you forget. Yeah. Secret?
Because you just assume R goes to infinity and then so E goes 0.
Good. That's exactly right. This goes to infinity, E goes to 0, and that's right. It's a very common rule, if you forget about things, take it to some extreme limit. Okay, and we were talking about why FRED is so useful. And the answer is 2 to 8 nanometers, or 20 to 80 angstroms, is just an extremely useful region for FRED. In particular, it can look at intramolecular. That is, if you have a protein here, which you label it on one side with, over here with a donor and with an acceptor, here you'll have little energy transfer. Then, for example, you add a ligand, it undergoes some conformational change, and then it undergoes a big increase in FRET. So this is an intramolecular. Or you have an intermolecular, again, where you have it labeled with donor acceptor, you add a ligand and it causes a molecule to dimerize. In which case, there you have a tremendous amount of energy transfer under the circumstances where it undergoes intermolecular FRET. So that's basically why FRET is so useful. Okay, and if we have an R naught, again, or bigger R, I shouldn't say R naught, you can use a Fiona type technique. Okay, now we're going to look at the properties of R naught. Turns out that R naught is equal to some number times J, which is the normalized spectral overlap of the donor emission and the acceptor absorption. We'll go through this somewhat. It is equal to the quantum yield of the donor times N, which is the index of refraction of the media, which is basically 1.33 for water, goes to the minus fourth. So that really generally is not a problem. And times this other parameter, kappa squared, which has to do with the dipole moment of the donor and the absorption of the emitter. And we'll talk about this a little bit more. Okay, so let's go through this. This, for example, is the donor emission. The absorption, you come in here, you lose some energy, you get Stokes shift, and you get your emission. And you have the donor, you have, the acceptor, you have some absorption and some emission. Notice that the acceptor is farther redshifted compared to the donor. Okay, and here, now what you see is a critically important factor called the spectral overlap. This is the J term. It basically is, there is a spectral overlap between the donor emission and the acceptor absorption. It's right here where they overlap. That is called the spectral emission, the spectral overlap. The greater the amount of spectral overlap, the larger R naught. The less the spectral overlap, the smaller R naught. And in fact, you can calculate. You can calculate J, as I'll show you in a second. So here you actually have an energy transfer signal. The emission of the donor decreases because some of the energy, in fact, is going to the acceptor. And so the acceptor emission increases. So you can get out the amount of energy transfer by a decrease here and an increase over there. Okay. And J here, what we is this term. So what is this term? How do you actually go and calculate what J is? So one thing we need to know is the fluorescence of the donor, and we have to know the absorption of the acceptor. So the emission of the donor and the absorption of the acceptor. And what happens is J is essentially this area. Now it's actually, you multiply it times lambda to the fourth. So you take this value and this value, multiply by lambda to the fourth, and then take this value and this value, multiply by lambda to the fourth, and you integrate. And you get the top, and then you just divided by that area on the bottom. Okay? The quantum yield of the donor, you can measure that. This n to the minus fourth we discussed. And now kappa squared. Kappa squared is one of the more difficult aspects. What it has three terms in here. Okay. What you have is the donor absorption, the acceptor acceptor absorption, and so there's a relative orientation between them, and also it depends on, for example, if it's like this versus if it's like this. That is the angle between the donor emission and the radius vector. And so what you can have is kappa squared can vary anywhere from 0 to 4. Tell me, Let's take three cases. In one case, you have... let's take actually another case. Let's say you have the case of the donor absorption and acceptor emission like this. Another case, you have it like this. In another case, you have like this, and you have like this. So tell me what kappa squared is for each of them. Good. Work together in groups of three. You can... Fine. Okay. Someone give me the answers. You're still working on it? Who has the answer? No one? Oh. I'll give you a few more minutes. Yeah.
of circles of the same
Okay. What about in this case? How do you get one?
The two dipoles are parallel, so the angle between them is zero. So the cosine of zero is one.
So this is zero?
Yes.
Okay, good.
And then for both of the dipoles are at a 90 degree angle with that R vector, so cosine of that of 90 degrees is zero. So
That's this, correct? Yeah? Okay, and you plug it in. Good. Okay. What about in this case? And by the way, for you can tell that this should be a finite, because the dipole is like this, and it's going up and back, and it's producing an electric field where the polarization is like that. So the electric field is generally aligned with the polarization of this. Okay? So kappa squared you get is 1, and therefore the spectral overlap will be non-zero. Okay, what about this? Well, wait. Yeah, you've given the answer already. Yeah?
All the angles are 0.
What's that? All the angles are zero. Yeah?
So K is 4. So K squared is 4.
Oh. They're all zero. How do you get that that's zero? Oh, as opposed to 180 degrees. No, you're right. Mu and R, they're parallel. So you get 0. Okay. Now, this is somewhat harder. What do you get here? Let's have a third person who has an answer. Anybody? Well, I'll tell you that these are either all, you know, each one is 0 or 90 degrees. I'll give you that. Anybody? What's the orientation between the R vector and mu sub A? Okay. So 90 degrees. What's the angle between mu sub D and R?
Zero.
What's the angle between the dipole moment of the donor with regard to the acceptor? Okay. So what do you get? The cosine of 90 degrees is 0 minus 3 times the cosine of 0, which is 1, times the cosine of 90 degrees, which is 0. So you get kappa squared equals 0. And the reason is fundamentally that the dipole, for example, is like this. And so it emits sort of like this. And mu sub A can't interact with this at all, because mu sub A dot E of the donor is 0. So you can't get any energy transfer between them. Okay.
Why is that the same type of lattice form?
Why is this?
The lattice is four.
Because in this case, its dipole moment is going like this. And mu dot E, E of, it's optimally aligned such that mu sub A can optimally interact with it. Okay, and now if you have this situation where both are randomly rotating very fast, which is often the case, they're not always, it turns out the integral goes to 2/3, so kappa squared equals 2/3, and that is often what is assumed, though it is not always completely correct. Okay? Okay. How to measure the energy transfer? We've talked about this already, but in fact, quantitatively, what we do is we take, there's a certain amount of the donor intensity. This is like, in this case, or even better, that the acceptor isn't even there. You have a certain intensity. Then you take the intensity when the acceptor is present at a certain distance. It decreases. You take the ratio, 1 minus, and that is the energy transfer. Or you can do lifetimes. You take the lifetime of the donor divided by the donor in their presence of acceptor and 1 minus that. Okay. The other way you can do is measuring it by an increase in the fluorescence. Turns out that what it ends up being is you take the intensity of the acceptor in the presence of the donor divided by the same thing plus the intensity of the donor in the presence of the acceptor. Basically, what it's saying here is this is getting larger as E is getting larger, and you divide it by essentially the residual fluorescence that was originally there. And you also have to divide it by the relative quantum yields. Maybe I'll give you a homework in terms of that. Okay. So let's give an example of how this actually works. And this is actually quite a famous paper, in that what they did is they have a donor and acceptor separated by various distances, n equals anywhere from 1 to 12. And you can see that there is spectral overlap between the donor and the acceptor. So J is there. And the fluorescence of the acceptor is well separated from the donor. Okay, so what they have here, you can see for n equals 1, where they're very close together, so you get an enormous amount of donor, and you get basically nothing from the acceptor. Is that quite true? 0% energy transfer, there's still some fluorescence due to just the acceptor. Why is that? So in this case, here you have the donor and you have the acceptor, but the acceptor is way far away. So you know you're not getting any energy transfer. But you're still getting some fluorescence from the acceptor coming. Why is that?
What?
That's right. Yes, I did. I wanted to see whether you guys were awake. And why is that? Yeah. Not quite. Say it again.
The spectra overlap. So even though they're far apart, when the donor emits its photon, that photon can be absorbed by the acceptor. The acceptor was then.
Yeah. No. That it turns out that so-called the donor gets excited and it re-emits, and that the acceptor happens to absorb it. It turns out that is very, very small. So actually, that's not significant. So you have the donor here and your acceptor here, and you go and you, for example, shine a green light. You go and excite the donor, and then, so what's happening? Why is the acceptor emitting at all? No, you know. Secret, you know?
Yeah, because the acceptor absorbs light and emits too.
That's right, because the acceptor has some absorption. You go and you mean to excite the donor, but you inadvertently excite the acceptor. And so it has some emission here. But then when you put the acceptor and the donor very, very close, wait, hold on, something's weird. So you put the donor, wait, so can anybody explain this to me? Can anybody other than Amin? This corresponds to n equals 1. And then, you know, we have n equals 12 and, you know, whatever. Okay, you have this is your 3-minute break, and during the 3 minutes, you can talk or think about this graph. It's in nanometers, 360 nanometers. This is millimicrons, which is nanometers. There is something funny about this.
Is that the graph for the daughter or for the extended? Because the wavelength is too small. It's like the extended should be the non-daughter.
Well, yeah, that the so this is here's fluorescence. So here, okay, the acceptor is emitting way out here at 540 nanometers. The donor is emitting at about 350 nanometers. So apparently, this is all the donor emission. The acceptor emission is out here. So apparently, what they're measuring is simply the donor emission. So the donor. So what should it be? When there's very little energy transfer, the donor emission is large or small?
Large.
Is large. This seems screwed up.
Could be.
So the donor emission here, donor emission should be very small. Yeah? We agree with this?
Yeah.
And then when it's far apart, donor emission should be large. Yes? So in this case, this is like n equals 1, and this is like n equals 12. This seems completely ass backwards. So I clearly have to go back and look. Okay. This is a very famous paper.
and very wrong.
Yeah. Clearly something's messed up. So I'll go back and try to think about this. But clearly they plotted the transfer efficiency as a function of the distance between the donor acceptor, and they here get exactly 1 over r to the 6 with in r naught 50%, here is about 36 angstroms, which is exactly what you expect. And in fact, you can plot this versus the log of this, and you expect to get an log this versus log this, and you get a slope of 6. So there is something that I'm thinking about wrong or something. So we'll figure it out next time. Very strange. Okay. In this, well, we have 15 minutes. We'll go through this. It'll be probably too kind of fast, but we'll give it a try. Okay. So hold on. Okay. It doesn't seem to like that. Okay. Well. Okay. What we have here is we have double-stranded DNA, and we want to look at its unzipping. The reason we want to do that is because we know that in this form, it's fundamentally inactive. The genes are turned off. There is no way to replicate them to produce proteins. So in order to replicate or do whatever, it needs to separate them, and it uses a protein called a helicase. And so, for example, one method, in fact, take a double-stranded piece of DNA, attach one end to a glass. The other end, you attach a donor to one strand and an acceptor to another. And so they're nice and close together. And so you'll have an enormous amount of energy transfer. Then you come in with a helicase whose job is to unwind the DNA. And you come in, and you'll immediately start to see that there's some separation, so you have less fret. And then it keeps going until eventually these won't hybridize at all, and you get zero energy transfer. Okay? And in particular, he was interested in looking at a particular helicase that comes from the hepatitis C virus. It's called NS3 helicase. And this is just by way of background, that HCV is a deadly virus affecting 170 million people in the world, but there's no cure or vaccine. The NS3 helicase is essential for replication because the DNA has to unwind. It has what is called a serine protease and a helicase domain. The helicase domain being the part of the structure that all helicases have. And does anybody have an idea what a serine protease is? Oh, good. I'm glad you know. What is serine?
Serine is
Serine? An amino acid, good. It's one of 20 or so amino acids. And what does a protease mean? That gives what? That takes apart a protein. Excellent. The reason, well, I don't know if you knew, is ACE is an enzyme and protein is exactly. So it takes a serine and it basically cuts the protein and renders it ineffective. Okay. So NS3, because it's in helicase, it unwinds, it turns out, both RNA and DNA. Okay. In fact, there was some earlier studies done on some, in this case, DNA that had a hairpin over here. And if you start to pull it over here, you find that it goes in steps. And in fact, you can look and you can find that it goes in yet smaller steps. And this is, so you have NS3 and it helps it unwind. And they had figured that it takes steps in basically 11 base pairs and sub-steps every 2 to 5 base pairs. Okay. What we're going to show in this study is, in fact, it goes down to a single base pair. Okay, so how are we going to watch it in an action? What we're going to do is label... we're going to attach it to a cover slip over here, and you have a 20 mer SS20, single-stranded 20 mer. And then you have a double-stranded 18 mer over here. So it forms a nice double-stranded complex. The double-stranded has an acceptor, and the other one hanging off of here has a donor. So at first, you're going to get an enormous amount of energy transfer. Then what you do is you go and add the helicase. The helicase comes along, and at first, there's a lot of fret, and then less fret, and then eventually, the helicase comes on, causes this to completely separate, and you get no fret. Okay? And this is just what you have, a decreasing amount of fret. What's the problem with doing this on an ensemble basis, that is, looking at many of these DNAs? Where in this study, he very particularly did a single molecule assay. That is, he looked at a single one. Why can't you look at many of them? Because in general, you know, it's difficult seeing a single donor and a single acceptor. So why not look at hundreds or thousands or millions of them at the same time? Yeah.
You
could place this guy here, and then you have another guy over here, and then another guy over here. So you can make the spacing of this such that this guy won't talk to another guy. Yeah. Explain more.
So if one strand is getting unzipped, another strand is getting unzipped, and they're complementary, they combine in different ways.
I still don't understand. What is recombining?
Well, it's just a base pairing between two different strands.
Okay. So you're saying that this is coming apart?
Yeah, and then it's recombining forming another helix structure.
With another guy?
Yeah.
Yes. To a certain extent. One thing I haven't told you is this is, this is here and this is here. And what you do is you add in some helicase over here. And when is it going to start to unwind? When is it going to start to unwind?
Maybe when the catechist is binding on this single strand.
Okay. When some guy here starts to bind on the single strand, and then it goes. Okay. So what determines when it goes? Okay, good. It turns out you have to add ATP for this guy to move. Okay? So how are you going to get, you want all of them to move at once? Because if they're going at random times, will you see anything? That this guy's going, so you have very low amount of energy transfer, and then another one, it hasn't gone, so it starts, and it hasn't started, and it has a high amount of energy transfer. You add that all together and you get some medium amount of energy transfer, but that doesn't show you anything. So it's this business of, can you get all of them to start at once, in which case everything's fine, but often you cannot get them all at once to start. So the point I'm making here is a very important point. I mean, it's why single molecules is a big field. I mean, it's why I have my position. And that's important. And if you're going to go into biophysics, well, single molecules is certainly not the only way to go, but it's really taking over because of the need to see a single one. Okay. So we're going to see a single one and watch it go. Okay. And this is an example. See, we had ATP initially. We go, here's the donor and acceptor. The donor initially high. The donor is initially low because there's a lot of energy transfer, and then the donor intensity increases and the acceptor intensity starts out high and then goes down. And then, in fact, so if you take the amount of FRET over here, you get something that looks like this. And if you look carefully, you can see that it actually goes in steps. In particular, there's six steps for an 18 base pair unwinding. So then what he does, he in fact shows that it's reproducible. But even more, he takes 9 base pairs. He adds ATP. And what happens is he gets 3 steps. So 3 steps with 9 or 6 steps with 18. So what he does is, in fact, you look that in general he finds here he was getting 6 steps with 18 bases and 3 steps with 9 bases, and so so what are you going to assume? That there is, what's that?
It will unwinding it's 3 base pairs.
That's right, by 3 base pairs. So if you assume that, you say every 3 base pairs there's a step. But actually you can go a little bit farther, because remember we built dwell time histograms for the molecular motors, and we also did it for ATPase, where in one case e to the minus t over tau, and this goes like t e to the minus kt for n equals 1. And then, in fact, I had you do a homework where you did not only for 1 sub-step, but for 2 and for 3. And the reason is here he did that, and he fit it, and the best fit he got for each of them is about 3 steps. Okay? So what he does is it says there must be 3 steps here corresponding to the so-called sub-step. There's 3 sub-steps corresponding to a step. So that, and each step was 3 bases. So that must mean that there are hidden inside of here, each one is a single base pair. For each ATP, you have a single base pair. Okay, and then you see, in fact, he always gets 3. And, okay, I guess, let me do it. Essentially, what he has is he has this guy. This whole thing is rather than do it, I'll do it next time. Okay. But from this, you will get a nice walking model where it's like an inchworm. It's really fantastic. Yeah.
We should try to meet regardless of whether we...
I assume we're going to hear something, but what if we don't?
Yeah, but also, if we hear something...
Yeah, well... Well,
till we hear something.
Yeah, and
I won't be here for the spring break, but when I come back.
I won't be here for Monday through Friday either. Well, let's assume we hear something, because I guess you had said that we would hear sometime this week.
If the period actually is March 29th to April 29th, that is the period in which submission is. So that actually is too close.
NSF is totally screwed up.
Absolutely.
I mean, they always do this. They all of a sudden, you know, they tell you, and then there's a huge rush. You have to submit it. You know, it's really impossible to do a good job. And then they take their time. Anyways.
I'll look back after spring break anyway. So in case, if you hear something, you will actually...
I'll send an email today. No. For 3 days, I'll be gone.
Yeah, that's
Do you have his email or his name or the email of the...
The guy?
Yeah.
I'll find a guy and send an email to you.
Okay.
And you telephone to him before.
This is totally ridiculous. Okay, well, nevertheless, let's hope they say yes.
Yes. So we